This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hot mics. Well, thank you everybody for being here. So nice to have you in the theater and very grateful for you sticking around for this conversation. My name's Tyler Morgenstern. I'm the assistant director of the Carsey Wolf Center. And it's my great pleasure to have with us tonight the associate producer of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Steve Starkey.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
And of course, one of the screenwriters for the film, Peter Seaman.
Thank you.
So, first, the two of you, welcome. This was a little bit long time in coming. There was a few hiccups along the way, so it's nice to just have you here and to see this show finally on the road. So very grateful to have you. Yeah. And we were talking a bit out in the lobby about this, but just to start off, when was the last time you two saw this film theatrically like this?
At the premiere in 1988.
We saw it on the 25th anniversary at the Academy, actually.
Oh, okay. Actually, we went to, and then we had like a little group, a gathering, that's right.
Yeah. They had the 25th at the Academy. They announced the screening. It sold out in like 5 minutes, 1,000 seats. And it turned out it was all people who'd worked on the movie. And they came from all over the world, because all these animators, they flew in from Czechoslovakia. And it was pretty cool.
Yeah, the animation was a reunion. It was based in London, but they did come from all over the world.
Wow.
The animators.
That's great. Well, I mean, there's so much to talk about with this film. It's such a marvel in so many ways. It's wonderful narratively. It's obviously wonderful technically. It's spectacular to look at. And we'll talk about all of that. But I kind of wanted to start with asking a little bit of a broad question, which sort of has to do with one of the most remarkable things about the film, which is that it kind of exists at all. In that it's worth remembering that this was a Disney show. This was a Disney production released through Touchstone. But the Disney of the 1980s was not the Disney that we know now. Throughout the 1980s, they were sort of up against the ropes. The animation unit in particular was a little bit shut down. The lights were dim over there. And then sort of the 1990s hits, and what hits is The Little Mermaid and The Lion King and, what else comes out? Oh, Beauty and the Beast and the whole Disney Renaissance, which really relaunches Disney and really puts it back in the camp of being a family entertainment brand. And it locks it into the Disney princess lane from which it really hasn't disengaged since. But one of the things that happens between the tough times of the 80s and the Renaissance is this one singular unicorn movie, which is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is kind of dark and it's kind of salacious and it's led
what?
By non like not what?
Was that the name of one of the weasels?
Yeah.
Salacious?
Yeah. Dark, salacious, yeah. It's led by non-legacy animation characters. I mean, we see some legacy animation characters, but Roger and Jessica were not legacy animation characters. They were not Mickey. They were not Goofy, necessarily. And it's led by a leading man who we love, Bob Hoskins, but we would not necessarily call him your conventional leading man.
No.
So it's a very unusual film that sort of feels like it couldn't have existed 5 years before and wouldn't have existed 5 years after. So I'm grateful that it exists at all, and I'm just wondering, thinking back on it as something so singular, can you tell us a little bit about how you both came to the project and how you came to know about it and get attached to it?
Well, Peter, you should start, because you came a lot earlier than I did.
Yeah. I was looking at the original script that my partner Jeff Price and I wrote. It was 1981, which is quite a while ago, and quite a while before the movie ended up in the theaters, which was in 88. We had been hired to do another film at Disney, the in-between Disney, starring Margot Kidder and Robert Hayes, called Trenchcoat, which is a very bad movie. But they didn't know it yet when they hired us to adapt the book for Who Censored Roger Rabbit, which was this movie came from. But that book was set in the comic world, the newspaper comic world, and we were hired to make it into the animation world, which was fallow at the time. But our research was sitting around watching, you know, Warner Brothers and MGM cartoons for months and months and months, which was great.
Tough gig.
Yeah.
And how did you come to be attached to this one, Steve?
It's funny. I was working over at Amazing Stories, a Spielberg failed television series, and aspiring to move on in the, you know, in the associate producer role that I had there. And I heard about this picture and heard about Zemeckis, and not knowing much more about it, I just clawed my way into it. But surprisingly, I had worked as an assistant editor on some Star Wars pictures, and I knew the producer of the film, so I contacted him. Yeah. And at the same time, the head of ILM, Lucas's company, contacted me and asked me to work on the picture to produce the visual effects. But I had supervised the post-production of visual effects on Amazing Stories, so I combined the two jobs and and got hired and met Zemeckis on the first day of shooting, and I introduced myself and said that what I was doing on the film, and he said, good luck.
Yeah. I mean, it's a challenging piece. There's a lot of moving parts in this film.
Yeah.
So can you recount, so was there anything in particular about the project or what you had heard about it, whether from a script level or from a sort of special effects and production perspective, that made you really attracted to it, that made you want to sort of get involved with this? You said you clawed your way into it. What was it about it that made you want to claw?
Well, just just hearing about the challenge of the thing, you know, I mean, there's a lot of Star Wars films were built on combining in a strange way, not animation, but, different elements into live action. Mm-hmm. And so this was taking it to another. And strangely, when I clawed my way into it, I hadn't read the screenplay. I'd only heard about this idea and then heard about Zemeckis and knew what he had done. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't know that much more. It was more just a something out there that I, you know, was aspiring to do. Okay. So it wasn't really actually the movie. It was more like just trying to get another job.
Fair enough. And what a job. And how about you, Peter? Was there something in particular about this story idea that you found particularly compelling?
Before trying to get in the movie business, I'd been working at the advertising business, and so had Jeff Price. And we'd made Tony the Tiger commercials, Snap, Crackle, Pop commercials, and we'd come out to L.A. And all those animators who were no longer working in the business were doing kid cereal commercials, and we got to know them. So we would hang with them in their bar called Bordner's, which was off Hollywood Boulevard. And so we were fond of animators and animation. When we got this offer to adapt the book, we jumped at it. We wrote several drafts of it at Disney. Zemeckis wanted to direct the movie, and at that time he was in movie jail because he just done Used Cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and they wouldn't let him make the movie. So time rolled on, the project left Disney and went to Spielberg and Amblin, and after Bob had resuscitated his career by making Back to the Future, Spielberg said, what do you want to do? I've got this, I got this thing, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And he said, yeah, I love that. I always loved that script. And so we got one of those calls that was out of the blue that you dream about as a writer when you've been taken off a project, which is Zemeckis saying, you know, Bob Zemeckis, I want to direct your script. And it was like he had remembered the very first cartoon we put in the very first script. Mm. And when Spielberg gave him the later draft, he said, no, that's not it. Give me the one with the bunny sitter cartoon, so we were back.
Well, I did want to follow up on that and ask about the work of adaptation for this, because this is based on source material.
Yes.
It's a wonderful, highly original script, but it's adapted from a novel called Who Censored Roger Rabbit, which, as you mentioned, is set in the world of newspaper cartoons and cartoon strips. And in that novel, the cartoon characters are sort of non-speaking in the way that they are in this film. They speak through speech bubbles that hover above their heads and so forth. And the source material is much darker, actually, than what ends up on screen here. Roger Rabbit ends up murdered. He's the one that's murdered in the novel. Sorry, spoiler. It's an old book. It's fine. So I'm curious, and it was set contemporaneously with its release, so it's set in the world of the 1980s, I believe. Mm-hmm. And this ends up being a very different sort of story world. This ends up being sort of an alternate post-war Hollywood. It's shifted into the world of motion pictures as opposed to comic strips. And I'm just wondering if you can reflect a little bit on sort of some of the choices or the challenges or what was exciting to you about making those changes and creating this particular story world.
It didn't come easily, and it wasn't like sort of automatically, okay, it's going to be 1947. That sort of evolved a little bit as when we met with Spielberg. He said, you know, I want to do this, I like the script, but you got to have a story that's worth telling. You can't just make a movie because there's a live-action detective and a rabbit. You know, what's what's the story? So you go find a story, and if it's worth telling, we'll make it. So, you know, Chinatown had been out. We'd seen that, and that was, you know, somewhat of an inspiration. But we had a friend of ours who lived in L.A. and said, hey, you know, there's got to be another Chinatown story out here. And he said, he talked about the red cars, and there was a whiff of conspiracy that the, you know, the auto companies and the tire companies and everybody had tried to get rid of the red cars for the freeways, which is, you know, true or not, but it's in there somewhere. And it, and that took place in the late 40s, also the heyday or the end of the heyday of animation. Mm-hmm. So that seemed the appropriate place to do it. Bob reacted well to all, you know, seeing old old Hollywood and having the challenge of filming it. So it all kind of came together that way.
Great. Well, and one of the aspects of this story world that I think is so interesting is not just that it's transposed into sort of post-war old Hollywood studio system, but obviously one of the most kind of compelling aspects of that story world is what we would now call its IP mixing, its intellectual property work, right? What's so interesting about this film is that we see characters from Disney, we see characters from Warner Brothers, all kind of mingling within the story world. And I think in a contemporary context, we're sort of familiar, I think we're too familiar, we're overly familiar with the notion of IP because of the way that filmmaking now is so heavily franchised, and we're used to universes and cosmologies of characters, and all of that IP stuff, intellectual property stuff, is very front of stage now in a way that it's part of the marketing cycles of movies, is the intellectual property work of it. But here, it's a little bit more built into the narrative world of the film itself because it's set in the context of a film studio. And so you've got characters like R.K. Maroon talking about how they've got Dumbo on loan from Disney and these kinds of things, right? It works within the story world because of the way that this whole space is constructed. So I'm wondering, maybe Steve and Peter, you can maybe chat about this together, but if you can reflect on what it took to bring all of these different sort of universes of characters together and how you go about creating a world visually and at the level of effects and also narratively where all of this makes sense. Because one of the things that's so great about this film is that it's not overly showy in the way that it combines the different universes. It positions all of the different tunes as kind of guns for hire, right? Actors looking for work, playing showrooms like Daffy and Donald are just like playing showrooms because they need a gig. So I'm wondering if you can reflect on some of that work that it took to put this world together and make it feel the way that it does.
You know, while he was talking, I was thinking of Roger appreciating Goofy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you kind of figure that all these tunes like actually, you know, since they appreciate each other's work, it seems logical that, you know, that they can work together. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, and it's kind of set up in a funny way, at least I thought, where, you know, and the same with Bugs and, you know, a Tweety Bird, and, you know, they know each other's stick, so they know how to play off of each other because that's what they love and that's what they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like it was organic in that way, you know, but it's all in the writing, you know, to get these you know, to get these characters seeming to be working together so well.
But you had pointed out when we were watching the film, early in the film when Eddie's on the Maroon lot, and you pointed out the first shot that was finished for the film, which is, I believe, the hippo in the tutu coming down the stairs and bumps into Eddie.
Yeah.
Is there something from the perspective of, like, working with these really complex visual effects where you were thinking about, well, we're dealing with two very different visual universes here. How do we make these things work together in a single film space?
I'm not exactly sure of the question, but you mean just how combining the live action, the animation worlds together?
Yeah, and also the different animation styles and the different types of characters that are present in the film.
Well, it was brutal from a production standpoint. I mean, because there's nothing there, and so you sort of have to imagine what's going on, especially in that first scene you're talking about, or in the Ink and Paint Club when they come in. Mm. I mean, there's no penguin there. There's no bartender there, you know? And so all that stuff had to be, I mean, it was very, very difficult. You know, one thing that ended up happening is it was sort of made in two parts. The live action was shot, and then it was animated to the live action being shot, like a year later or something. Mm. It was started. And so you actually got two bites of the apple from a writing standpoint, to you know, reimagine when you see what you've actually shot and where the weasels might go and who's talking to who. And so we had a chance to, you know, rewrite a movie halfway through, which was actually pretty fun. But the physical part of it was absolutely, absolutely brutal. And it went on and on and on. And it made, you know, it made Bob Hoskins half crazy, trying to, like, keep it straight where the weasels were, you know?
Right, we were talking.
But Hoskins was, you know, he was not only a brilliant actor, but he was one who could visualize these toon characters in space, mm-hmm. which is a lot harder than you can imagine. If you're just, you know, all of these scenes were plotted out with little puppets when we shot it. Mm. So you had the camera, and either Bob or the director of photography would run around with a little puppet and show the action of where these characters would go throughout the filming. And the actor's there watching, the character move around, and now he's going to hear the voice of this character off camera while they're shooting. But still, he has to imagine where he is. But not only does he imagine, he has to fix his eyes in space where that character is for you to believe that he's interacting at the right space. You know, he can't just, like, his eye line can't go out to the end of the room because mm-hmm. the character's right in front of him. So he has to create a focus in front of him and keep his eyes focused right there as he's watching this character move, not let his eyes go distant.
Right.
So the believability that these actors brought to you know, having the characters in their space is what sells this animation. Without these great actors doing that work, it wouldn't have worked.
Right, and we were talking backstage that, again, sort of from a contemporary perspective, it's easy to imagine how a film like this is sort of put together. We're used to seeing behind the scenes footage of actors talking to tennis balls, or, you know, behind the scenes footage of Avatar being made, and people are in mocap suits and diving over foam rollers and all these sorts of things, and we're used to seeing that. But really, at the time, this was like a major, major technical challenge, and to ask somebody like Bob Hoskins to talk to
and it was done on film.
And it was done on film, not easy to do.
And all the animation was drawn on cells. Wow. It was painted. You know, so none of this was, the new digital technology hadn't taken hold. So, you know, it was all done old school, if you will, and then combined on an optical printer.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it was a huge under, you know, all the lighting, you know, normally when you see these classic cartoons you're thinking of, all the light and shadow is embedded in the drawings of these characters. Right. It gives the depth to the characters and the space in the cartoon. But here it was all added later. So every shadow, every bit of highlight on the characters was added on these blank cells of drawn animation mm-hmm. to create the depth on the characters to believe that they're in the same space as the actors.
Right.
So it was a layered process.
Yeah, there's so many beautiful animated lighting effects. There's a moment when Roger's talking about how laughter is one of the most powerful weapons that we have, and he gets this kind of halo soft focus light around him, and it's an animated lighting effect, and it's really, and it lasts just a few seconds, but really beautiful.
Well, Bob, you know, Bob, when he went into the back room where it was the shave and the haircut,
he
goes, and so Bob says, you know, I think you should come in and bump that lamp so the light keeps swinging, so we see the light go on Roger and off. And the animators are going, oh,
no. please.
It was hard enough just to paint it. So now we have to have light drifting on, Roger, light going off, and it's going off the characters. And, you know.
Not easy stuff. Well, speaking, I want to return to something you said earlier. So you had said you had kind of heard of this project, Steve, and you kind of clawed your way into it, and Zemeckis greets you the first day of shooting, and he says, good luck. Mm. And I'm curious if you can reflect a little bit about you had mentioned, Peter, that the animation here and the effects are so difficult, the experience of actually working through this film, simply because part of the challenge here was not just doing this complex animation work, a lot of it was inventing technology along the way to make the animation down the road possible. So you recount stories in your book, for instance, of having to create a sort of dome to enclose the Panaflex cameras so that the sound of the cameras wouldn't interrupt the shooting, so that you could then go back and do VFX later and these sorts of things. And you're coming off of large, challenging projects as well. When he says he did some Star Wars movies, it was Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. These are not, you'd mostly been at Industrial Light and Magic. So can you just sort of like reflect a little bit on your trajectory coming out of ILM, picking up on this project, and the kind of work that you had to do to make this film technically possible?
Well, when I first got onto the set, was down in LA, and the very first thing I saw was that you had Lou Rawls. You had, you know, the voice of
Benny the Cab.
Was Benny the Cab until, you know, you changed it to this. But anyway, well, that's what, when Peter was talking about, you know, getting to rewrite. I mean, one of the great rewrites that Jeff and Peter and Bob did on the ADR stage was changing that character, Benny the Cab, I mean, into that New York cabbie.
That's Charlie Fleischer, too, the voice of Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, who just started spinning, you know, just started spinning a thing. Wow. And these guys took to it and just started writing on the re-recording stage. And then we had this character. But anyway, when I arrived on the set, I saw the VistaVision camera was shooting these cartoon sections of the film, and the VistaVision camera was housed in a giant blimp.
Right.
And that was to soundproof it so you could keep the dialogue, because the VistaVision camera grinding through this film in 70 mil, you know, in VistaVision, was so loud you couldn't hear anything but this grinding film in the camera. So they had a big blimp on it. Well, every time you changed the camera load, you had to take this blimp off. It was a huge, and it only ran half the amount of film as a 35 millimeter camera. So they were building what they called a VistaFlex camera, which was the first of its kind, which was a Panaflex, a normal 35 camera, but in VistaVision. Mm. It was supposed to be ready for the first day of shooting, and it wasn't. So the first thing that I confronted going, you know, I went up to ILM. Well, I asked Ken, I said, is this how we're going to shoot the movie? He said, that's a sore subject. We were supposed to have these new cameras ready to start shooting. Mm. But anyway, they're going to be ready when we travel to London after the first of the year. So I went up to ILM, and these guys were still working on them. Mm-hmm. And I said, guys, these cameras are going with me on the airplane when I fly to London. And they said, well, if they're done. I said, no, they're going. So that was the first challenge, was getting what I'll call a production practical camera to shoot a movie that had half the movie requiring, the VistaVision format. Mm-hmm. That was the very first challenge. You know, when we got there, my cohort, the other associate producer, Don Hahn, who headed up the animation division, none of us knew the methodology from filming to then what happens.
Right.
So what do you, okay, we got this thing then, and it's in, you know, it's in VistaVision, so what do we do next? So we go down, we make a 35 millimeter reduction, we edit. So we cut the scene. Well, we have to finalize the voices. So you have to cast everybody. I mean, we recorded some of it with Charlie Fleischer on the set. But most of the characters that you hear were recorded in post-production. They weren't recorded on the set. It was usually the script supervisor, maybe an actor or two. But so we had to re-record it, lock the scene, then go and created what we called a photostat, or a background of every frame in the film that the animators could put on their animation stand and draw the animation for each frame of the movie, and then string those together. Mm-hmm. So then those went, so the book told every step of the way how to finish a shot.
Right. Is there any,
I won't go through all the details.
Well, I'm thinking about like knowing how complex and slow that process is. Is there like any particular shot or sequence, like watching this film in the theater now after a number of years, where you're like having like night sweats and night terrors thinking about how hard it was to finish? Like, is there a particular sequence where you're like, oh yeah, that one almost killed me?
Well, you know, strangely, the shot you're talking about, he comes out of the, you know, when he looks out the window when he's in Maroon's office and looks down into that courtyard and sees multitudes of tunes doing, you know, playing instruments and screaming across and the cattle call and all that stuff. That was a huge shot. It was one of the first shots, it's so early in the movie, one of the first shots we did, but it was a monster shot. Mm-hmm. So that's one that stands out. I don't know if you think of others.
Yeah, the movie almost stopped after that one.
Yeah.
Because it was so hard, and Zemeckis said, let's try everything. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
And it was just so damn hard that the studio was like, oh, man.
Well, that's one of the things also about the film that's, like, so compelling, is that, like, it's got all these incredible technical challenges and all these, like, really interesting things that are specific to the film, but it also doesn't stop being a Bob Zemeckis film, in that the camera never stops moving, and there's crazy action sequences. I mean, it's so thoroughly a Bob Zemeckis film, plus all of this additional stuff, that it's kind of remarkable that it all holds together, but it looks wonderful.
You know, Bob is not intimidated by visual effects. Yeah. And I think the key, this camera thing I was talking about, the key was he wanted to shoot this like a live-action movie. Mm-hmm. That the cartoons were in there just like, you know, other live characters. And so he didn't want to stop, he didn't really want to change his style of how he would direct the film, compose shots. He wanted it to just flow like a normal movie.
Right.
Despite the fact nothing was there. Mm-hmm. So that was the, you know, so that was the method.
Kudos to Bob. Well, so obviously many complex technical needles to thread here, but I do want to return to a question of storytelling and pick up on something that you mentioned earlier, Peter. So this film has to thread also a particular needle narratively, which is, I mean, it's its own particular story world. It's zany, it's off the wall, it's cartoons, it's this, that, and the other thing, it's noir, it's all of these things. But it also, it is really a bit of allegorical storytelling. I mean, as you mentioned, the sort of pretense here of the red car and the trolley lines and the public transit system in LA being ripped up by interests in private automobility and all these things. These were real things that happened. But also I'm interested in there's a sort of segregation plot here. There's a story about a particular class of entities in this world or beings in this world who are segregated into a particular part of the city, into Toontown. And when they do mix with humans, they mix uneasily. They are relegated mostly to entertainer roles or service roles and these sorts of things. So there is something that you could read as sort of like an allegory for a kind of race, a race politics here. And actually in the history of LA, these things converge. When the freeways got built, they got built directly through majority black and brown neighborhoods. When the 10 gets punched out to the coast, it goes straight through Sugar Hill, which was a black suburb, and demolishes Sugar Hill. And major parts of LA's post-war and mid-century redevelopment happened in places like Chavez Ravine and Bunker Hill and other neighborhoods that prior to being what they are now, which is Dodger Stadium and the Broad and the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, all these sorts of things, were largely working class enclaves. And so it's an interesting experience to watch this film because these are sort of like fairly heady political and historical issues, and we're approaching them through animation. And so I wonder if in adapting the source material and taking on noir and transposing it into a separate time period, you're also trying to think about the sort of politics of the script and how you take that on, knowing that you're working with cartoon characters of all things.
Tyler, I am so glad you picked up on it.
You couldn't have said it better, could you?
I mean, that was, you know, we certainly had a lot of that in the back of our mind. And because it was a cartoon setting, you can get away with a lot of stuff you couldn't normally get away with. And so it was, you know, the racism is subtle, but it's certainly there. And it plays out in kind of the Tex Avery way, you know, which, you know, people get whacked on the head and they, you know, birds fly around and that's that's the beating you take when you're a toon. And so it's really not real, but they certainly are second class citizens. And that Ink and Paint Club scene is still my favorite. I love, you know, when it's nothing there and the door opens and then there's this whole other world, and it's a world of entertainment in the same way, you know, the black entertainers made their way in places like that, and dives and speakeasies, and that's was their way out. And so the tunes in this are, you know, nobody has to know that to appreciate it, besides maybe yourself. And but it was certainly there. And you know, we were careful, we thought, to try to do it the right way.
Yeah.
And you know, honor the differences, but we didn't get stuck on it. We tried to have fun.
Yeah, and knowing from like a writing perspective or a narrative perspective, knowing that you're working sort of between a live action world that is beholden to a certain set of ideas around physics and people dying and how things fall and how things move, and knowing that you're also working with this sort of elastic logic of animation and cartooning, how does that inform how you construct a narrative, what seems plausible, what seems functional, what is a thing that you can ask Bob Hoskins to do, knowing that he's playing off a cartoon character eventually.
Well, I know one thing. We spent, you know, hours, days, months sitting around a table, Zemeckis and Jeff Price and myself, saying, does a tune bullet kill a human bullet, would it go through a tune and just make a hole? Well, you know, all the physics of it, it just drove us nuts.
And he's a stickler for rules.
Yeah. and so, you know, we spent a lot of time with that. What, you know, when, like, Bob Hoskins is in Toontown, you know, everything's up for grabs. When
when
Droopy puts him in the elevator, he gets squashed down and then he's on the ceiling. So there's different rules apply in Toontown.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried to be responsible for, you know, what makes sense. And then we came up with, like, the dip.
Right.
How do you get rid of a cartoon character? You know, it's paint, you know, like, all right, a little benzene, turpentine. I know that works.
Acetone.
That's the thing that's so terrifying about Judge Doom, is like, because the entire rest of this world makes it very clear that tunes are unkillable. They bounce back, they stretch, they bounce, they whatever. The maniacal brain it has to take to figure out how to wait to permanently kill a tune is so demented. That came from the partner.
That's Jeff.
Okay, well, Jeff should seek help.
But it's so logical, isn't it, that the measles die from laughing,
and
that Roger, you know, tries to make people laugh.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and there's just so many, like, wonderful little things written into the script that are so much about the animation as well. The moment when Roger's flipping through the patty cake photos, and we have a little flipbook animation that's so beautiful. And I also recalled when I was thinking about the film earlier today, the way that the opening animation sequence, us watching the opening animation sequence and then the film transitioning into live action, that gets mirrored in the film with Roger watching the animated short of Goofy, which then transitions into a boring newsreel and these sorts of things. There's these really wonderful ways that the writing and the storytelling plays with the sort of technical facts of the film, which I think is really lovely.
Well, people forget that every movie started with a cartoon once upon a time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the opening short here is stunning.
Yeah.
So amazing. Stunning. Can you talk a little bit about that short, how that came to be, Steve?
Well, it was, you know, that was conceived of before I got started, you know, but it was what they were working on when they didn't have anything else to do. Because at the beginning, you know, until we started shooting and locked scenes and got them fresh animation that they could go to work on, combining with the live action, they had this giant cartoon to do, which, you know, the whole studio was working on, the animation facility, you know, until we were up and running.
Right.
So that was all conceived by Richard Williams, who is the brilliant animation director of the film, and actually the voice of the character in the elevator. But
Droopy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
He insisted on doing it. He said, I know exactly how to do Droopy, so just let me do it. But
that's interesting, because this is actually, I believe, Mel Blanc's last actual cartoon performance,
His
last vocal performance.
Died soon after that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So not all of the original voices, but the Mel Blanc characters were the actual original performance.
Yes, definitely.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. All the way to Porky Pig.
Yeah. Mel Blanc, R.I.P.
But his son actually picked up the mantle.
Yeah, he did a lot of it.
Oh, really?
Did a few parts as well.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, the voice work is so fantastic, so that's really great to hear.
And actually, Mae Castell, who does Betty Boop and June Foray. I mean, some of these classic, you know, who did Natasha and the Bullwinkle. She came and she did Lena Hyena.
Oh.
I mean, there are all these people who, from the voice animation world, who also poured into the film to lend their voice to the show.
Wow, that's fantastic. I wonder, Steve, because following this was your first collaboration with Bob Zemeckis. But you've gone on to work with him many, many times since. You've worked with him on Forrest Gump, two of the Back to the Future films, Death Becomes Her, Contact, Cast, and a number of other films. And then you actually became producing partners on a venture that you've founded called Image Movers, which is a mocap company, motion capture organization. And the film that came out of that, the first film to come out of that, was The Polar Express that you worked on with Bob. So you've had this long history of collaboration with Bob. And I can wonder, I wonder if you can explain to us a little bit about what it is about his working style, your working style, his particular directorial vision, and what you find exciting about effects work that led you into Image Movers and this long collaboration that you've got with Bob.
Well, you know, it's funny how these partnerships, you know, it'd be like Jeff and Peter, you know, finding like-minded people who share sensibilities and sense of humor and styles. And so with Bob right away, you know, we traveled to London, I think it was like 15 times, to do what we called these turnover sessions, where we would go and cluster around an editing machine, and Bob would carefully talk through exactly what these characters, animated characters, were doing for the animator that was going to draw the characters. Mm-hmm. So going to and from London all these times and doing all this post-production work, we just became kind of tied to the hip. Mm-hmm. So it was, even going on to the Back to the Future films following that, it was sort of like, well, Steve, this is what you're doing. It wasn't a question. I wasn't his producer, but I was going to now be his right-hand man for a lot of that. So after he took a little leave of absence and did Death Becomes Her, he asked me to come and produce the film with him. And the wonderful thing about Bob is every movie, you don't know. I remember when a new agent took over, CAA, who was representing Bob, and said, so, Steve, you know, I just don't know, like, what kind of projects to find for Bob. I really, you know, for his next project. And I said, I don't have any idea. I mean, you know, what's wonderful working with him is every film out of the gate, whether it would be like Death Becomes Her, Roger Rabbit, or, you know, a Forrest Gump or a Castaway, What Lies Beneath, they all have these different sensibilities, and you don't know what it is that locks him in and says, I want to do that movie. You know, but so I found that very compelling. And also, he likes to challenge himself. He likes to challenge the filmmaking process, not just the storytelling. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of up to that challenge because of what I had done in my past work. So as soon as, like, a Polar Express, you know, how are we going to turn a pastel painting and bring that painting to life was okay, and you just start seeing it and figure out, you know, methods to get this vision of what he sees. You know, mm-hmm. I want one actor to play three characters in the same scene. Well, there's never been, at that time, in Back to the Future 2, there had never been a camera that could repeat itself and allow you to take an actor out and put another one in its place and keep moving it around until you got all three in the same frame. But he wrote it. They knew what they wanted. They didn't know how to do it. So then that becomes, so Steve, how are we going to do this?
Right.
And then you go marching down that road. So I just love the challenge of reinventing the cinema, of telling a story. I mean, that's what's really fun. So we kind of shared that. I don't know. And when Peter and Jeff write something that's, Rick Carter called it insurmountable opportunities. You know,
right.
You want to climb that hill, figure it out.
Well, I began by talking about how singular this film is, right? It emerges at this particular time in Disney's history, its evolution as a family entertainment brand, and it seems like a really kind of off-the-wall, strange project, but nonetheless, it hits, right? And it hits big. It's received very warmly by critics and audiences. It opens north of $11 million for its first weekend, which made it Disney's biggest ever opening weekend at the time, I believe. It goes on to make over $100 million domestically, nominated for 7 Oscars, wins 4, Best Editing, Sound Effects, Visual Effects, and a Special Achievement Award for Animation Director Richard Williams. And it wins a whole bunch of other awards domestically and internationally, and remains a part of the Disney universe. Toontown still exists in the theme parks and so forth. And it has this really enduring popularity and love around it. And so I wonder, looking back now all these years later and seeing it again and seeing it theatrically, what do you think the sort of like legacy or the longer term life of a film like Who Framed Roger Rabbit is in a kind of broader cultural or technical sense? Like, what ground does this film break that you still see reverberating as you continue to work in the film industry?
You want to handle that one, Starko?
No, I'll let you.
Look, it was really fun seeing it again. You know, especially on the big screen, it was fantastic. And I've only seen it like, I don't know, 3 times since '88 on a big screen like this. So you know, it holds up. I feel like it does, which is, you know, the first thing you kind of go, oh, you know, how's that going to work? But it does continue to work. I mean, I'm proud of You know, I'm proud of the fact that it's not Disney-esque. It was a little naughty for the, you know, for the.
That's why it's a Touchstone film.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why there's not another one, I guess. But yeah. It was really kind of groundbreaking, and I'm proud of that. And you know, and you wonder if it didn't really help reinvigorate Toondom. Mm. You know, because after that, Disney, you know, and Warner Brothers. And by the way, I mean, one of the hardest things, and it was sort of, you know, international politics, and only Steven Spielberg could pull it off, was to get Warner Brothers to let Bugs get in there with Disney and Mickey and those and the two ducks. That was just, yeah.
That was huge.
Huge.
Yeah. The only thing I think we would turn down is Felix the Cat.
Felix the Cat, for whatever reason. Felix. Oh, no, you can't Mickey. And so that is historic, and that will never happen again. And you know, back into their vaults with those right. characters, never to be seen together again. So there was all sorts of stuff that, you know, I'm still proud of, and I, you know, I mean, I guess these guys will tell us, but mm-hmm. but it seems to still work, you know.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I mean, it's just thrilling to think that, like you said, animation was in its doldrums, mm-hmm. and then this picture comes out that really just spins itself into another universe of animation, but it reinvigorated the art form. Mm. And a lot of the animators that, in fact, were the key animators on this movie became animation directors on some of the movies that immediately followed Roger Rabbit. Mm. And so they came over sort of on loan to our picture because they had nothing to do.
Right.
There were no real pictures at Disney. You know, so they came over and lent a hand. And then all of a sudden, they were all working. Mm-hmm. I mean, Disney just flourished. And so, you know, it's nice to get an art form back on its feet. And, you know, so I think that was really a fun aspect looking back on it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.